So, I will now tell a story over the backing music. So feel free to make yourself comfortable, and also you can let me know if if I need to speak louder so that you can hear me clearly. And you can also let me know to speak qu more quietly so you can hear the music better. I'm thinking to speak about a couple of paramis, which in a way we've already touched upon them. So these are the beautiful qualities of wisdom and also the beautiful quality of equanimity, which is actually a really hard word to translate. So I was translating it in when we were down in the bunker as transcendence. You may remember that's the last thing I said, and then we transcend back up the stairs. Things have gotten a lot better for us since then. For others, maybe not so much. But this idea of transcendence, another way of describing it is non-reactive response. And that's quite transcendent because typically we're pretty reactive people, pretty reactive species. So it's quite a transcending thing to come to that capacity, come to that conclusion that that's the right thing to do. Not react to ourselves, not react to the world around us. Let's start with wisdom. As one will do, if you kind of search through your mind, you come up with these, you may have this illness as well. You find these quotes come up in your mind. You think, who said that? Was that Albert Einstein? Was it Gandhi? Was it the Buddha? Was it Dalai Lama? Probably attributed to everyone on the internet somewhere. So this is one that I, as far as I know, was Albert Einstein. And I like Albert Einstein. He seems to be really bright and also pretty funny kind of person. So let's say this is by Albert Einstein, we think. A clever person solves a problem. A wise person avoids it. A clever person solves a problem. A wise person avoids it. I like this quote, although I don't think it's at all relevant to what I want to speak about, but I like it, so I thought I'd share it. Because I have no doubt that the Buddha was wise, a wise being. I also think that the Buddha was clever. A clever being. And very poetic. Very helpful. And so I don't think that they avoided problems, this problem of dukkha. They came face to face with it. But I think that there's something that they did more than they solved dukkha. They resolved, they dissolved it. And maybe we could say ultimately they actually avoided taking a side against it, for it or against it. Tammy was speaking about this crossing the floods. So the translation I know is without pushing forwards, without holding back. Something avoiding the typical responses that we would have towards a problem. So the Buddha was clever, wise, poetic. And also skilled enough to take something really complex and make it pretty simple. Be able to turn something transcendent into a path that we can move along. And I think that one of the most helpful qualities of the Buddha and then these Buddhist teachings that we're exploring, opening, was actually a quality of discipline. Actually a quality of discipline. In the teachings themselves, maybe that already makes sense to you, but I just want to kind of unpick it a little bit. Like, the Buddha was incredibly disciplined in practice. At the time, there were these types of people called ascetics who lived an incredibly disciplined existence. They lived out in the wilds. They lived on very little food. They did very, very austere practices, really hard practices. You know, the Buddha talks about doing these practices in the teachings, you know, relaying them, and it's like, you know, I used to hold my breath forever, you know, just hold the breath, not breathe, not follow the breath, not mindfulness of breathing, but actually just withholding the breath until the body just kind of feels like there's a raging storm within it. And you just stay in that incredible discipline, you know, living on meager amounts of food, you know, it's like, you can count the number of grains of rice that they're eating in a day,
yeah,
on one hand. Continuing in these ways. You know, it's said that the Buddha's skin, and probably the others around them, the skin turned to like paper and just started to peel off. Yeah, such a discipline to the practice. And was able to train this heart and mind to transcend to different realms, different perceptions, different dimensions of reality, to explore all of this and see if this brought freedom. And some of it would contribute towards these teachings of freedom, but a lot of it would just say, no, that wasn't the right way. But they had the discipline for that. But the discipline, I think, is much more interesting, is actually the discipline in the teaching. The discipline in the teaching was to resist saying what wasn't directly helpful towards one simple goal. If this that I'm about to say will not resolve dukkha in this being in front of me, I'm not going to say it. That discipline to stay on the message for many, many decades of teaching, I think it's something incredibly impressive. And something that I'm not very good at doing. Yeah, so I will not resist temptations. Is that the right way around? I will resist temptations? No, I won't. I won't resist temptations. I was right the first time. So the Buddha's here, you know, I teach one thing.
Yeah.
And would see us and would encourage us to see ourselves as if we're someone whose hair is on fire. Yeah. We haven't got time for small talk. Your hair is on fire. Here's the bucket. Put your head in the bucket, right? And treating this issue of dukkha, of unnecessary suffering, of unnecessary stress, agitation, ill being, yeah, as something to bring to an end. So teach dukkha to bring it to an end. You know, Buddha would often say it, you know, this discipline would say it out loud. You know, I'm only here for one thing. You can ask me other questions and I won't answer them because I'm only here for one thing. Yeah. I'm a dukkha liberation vending machine that's only got one button. The end of dukkha. And you push the other button. The end of dukkha, yeah. Okay, there's two buttons, but they say the same thing. And they're dukkha and the end of dukkha, yeah. And all the practices that come from that, solves, resolves, dissolves, and eventually avoids any problem at all. Right. Disappears problems, avoids in that sense. And so this path is actually really engaging in life in a radically freeing way. Yeah. All of these practices, all of the teachings, all the things that we're exploring is seeing, can we engage with our life in a radically freeing way? One that actually, the more and more we do it, we resolve the stress, the difficulty, the agitation. We're doing this here. We're contributing to this here. But have you noticed it's starting to actually turn things on their heads? Right? It's starting to also do what these other practices were doing. It's like opening us up to different dimensions of reality, yeah, different ways of seeing this experience, different aspects to our lives. And that happens, but that's side effects, because it's all in the service of freedom from dukkha. Yeah, so what is this dukkha? Yeah, what is this dukkha we experience? Just to check that we're really clear, right? This feeling of stress, ill ease, agitation, multiple hindrance attacks, yeah, where we find ourselves on the very edges of the level of experience that I was trying to describe with this matrix of hindrances type of idea. But in essence, it's any experience of non-freedom. So this question for us, how do you feel not free right now? What do you feel not free to do? Is there anything? Anything you don't feel free in, with, from? Why in this moment are we not at peace in ourselves, with our world? Is it something out there? Is it something in here? Is it both? Is it neither? Are we at peace? Maybe we're at peace. One of the aspects of these teachings is actually to do with this journey, this quest that we're on. This quest is led by questions. And are we asking the right questions of our experience? I think that's a really important question. Are we bringing the right approach? Are we asking the right questions of experience? So there's a part of this path which is called being skillful with questioning. Being skillful with our questioning. It's part of what it means to be wise. It's to ask the right questions in the right way. Sometimes we're asking a question, we're really seeking a resolution to this question, but maybe it's not the right question. Maybe it's not an answerable question, or maybe it's not a liberating question. I'll speak to that, what that might mean in a moment, but I was just remembering this quote of Alan Watts, who's another person who I really like, who I also think is really clever and wise and funny. And they would also say, problems that remain persistently insoluble, can't be solved, should always be suspected as questions asked in the wrong way. Problems that remain persistently insoluble should always be suspected as questions asked in the wrong way. Yeah, or for the wrong ends. Like, how do I stop thinking? Why am I thinking so much? You know, these kind of questions, like, you don't stop thinking. It does. It stops on its own. But the more we think about it, the more thinking there's going to be about, have I stopped thinking yet? You know, it's checking for the wrong thing. It's not going to end in that way. Yeah. The kind of counterfactual we can ask there is, how can I get more thinking? How can I really think endlessly? Like, you know, add more and more and more thinking. Could I cram more thinking into this mind? And if I couldn't, that's interesting. There's a simple thing that we can do around boredom. I think this came up in one of the groups. Can you get more bored? When you feel bored, can you get more bored than that? Yeah. And it's a really interesting thing because boredom needs rejection. Huh. Boredom needs rejection. If you're not rejecting boredom, what is it? There's calmness and there's not wanting it. If we subtract the not wanting it, peace. That's odd. Try and get more bored. Try and think more. So we ask these questions a different way. And what does this really depend? That's what we're interested in. That's what the skillfulness of question is seeking us to understand. What's this really depending on? How much do I need to reject what I'm already with? What's already here? It's already here, yeah? Do you want to spend your time rejecting it or accepting that it's here and accepting that there's something we can do about it? I think I'll come on to that point in a minute. just want to explain a little bit about skillful with questioning. So the Buddha would actually say there are four types of questions in the world. They would like to do these kind of things. There are four kinds of questions in the world. Practitioners, did you know this? And they're like, no. And he's like, well, there are questions that deserve a straight answer. There are those that need their terms redefined. Yeah, it's like, what do you mean by thinking? You know, say, redefine that so that we can actually know what we're talking about. The third are those deserve a counter question in response. What are you going to do when you stop thinking? And those that should be put aside. Yeah, questions that should just be put aside. So those that need a straight response, those that need a bit of definition around the terms, those that need a counter question, and those that should be put aside. So in other words, some frames of questions are useful. Useful for what? For freedom, right? The Buddha's only interested in one metric of things, yeah? Not, is that question interesting? Would that be fun to talk about? You know, would that, you know, be a nice opener and create a good connection between us? It's only about, is that going to bring you more freedom? Is that going to put out your hair that's on fire? Yeah. A really good example of this being skillful in questions is actually around a question that some people take a stance on, you know, the existence or non-existence of free will, the existence or non-existence of a real self. Yeah. And the Buddha wouldn't answer that question. Yeah, if that question was asked directly, so is there a self or is there not a self? The Buddha would stay quiet, not respond to that question, put that question aside. And yet it can be one of the really kind of central questions that we ask ourselves and that we notice that it comes up in the teachings. Ah, there's this teaching on not self. It's teaching on not self. Ah, it must mean that there is not a self. But actually, it's an encouragement, an invitation to take up a view. Take up a view. See the perception of there isn't a self. And see what that does to the situation. Right? So the skillfulness with the question isn't to give it an answer, but actually say, well, what if it wasn't? What if there wasn't something there? What if this isn't your body? Aren't your thoughts? Aren't your sensations? Then how do you meet them? How do you experience them? How is that? Does it bring freedom? Right, so the practice is offered not because it's true, but because it's useful. Not because it's true, but because it's useful. And this can take a little bit of getting used to, but really, it doesn't matter to us if this is true or not. It doesn't matter. It feels like it matters, doesn't it? It's like, but is it true? Is there a self or is there not a self? It doesn't matter. What's it like to say there isn't? What's it like to say there is? What's it like to feel the freedom to be able to apply that or not? The more important point is, what does this do? What does this view do for us? What does it do for us when we believe there's a self? What does it do for us when we believe there isn't? So questions take us on quests. There's a karma to questions. There's an activity to questions. They take us on journeys. Yeah. And so for the Buddha, the journey, the quest, is the relief of suffering. Yeah, the relief of dukkha. Freedom. The opening of the heart, mind, being into freedom, into peace, peace beyond peace. The relief of stress, the dissolving of ill-being. And, you know, I don't want to make the choice for you. That might not be what you're into. And that might not be what you want to do, but you do need to ensure that your questions are aligned to your deepest values, to your deepest intentions, yeah. That you're asking these questions, practicing this path in that way. So on this path, now we're saying that there are things which may not be true, but can be useful. And on this path, I would say, useful is much more important than true. Yeah. Now, you don't always have to make a choice, but sometimes we say, it doesn't matter if it's true. If it's useful, we'll use it for what it's useful for. And speaking in this way, we're starting to get into like uncertainty territory. So, And that's also the territory of doubt. Earlier, someone asked me, you know, so what is this doubt hindrance? You didn't really talk about that very much. So the reason that I didn't talk about it very much is that I didn't want to spend too much time on it because I feel like it's really a given, right? It's really a given in our experience that we're doubting ourselves, doubting our capacity to do things. But I also didn't speak to it so much because it takes a long time to talk about this thing, because I don't think that doubt is really the right word. I don't know what you've used in Hebrew to translate it, but I doubt it's the right word as well. And this doubt that I'm talking about is actually quite good. It's a good thing. Doubt is a good thing. You may remember I actually mentioned this on the opening night. I might be wrong. I might be wrong about this. Right? Whatever, however things are unfolding, I might be wrong. Right? So we can be too certain about things, too certain that this, you know, voice I have within myself that's defining me and telling me how I am or how things are, whatever, is like, yeah, that's true. I believe it. Maybe sometimes we believe it too much. We actually want to doubt that. And so the doubt hindrance also includes a certainty. So it's actually a question. What am I not doubting? What am I actually believing? Believing to be true. Believing to be true. And probably believing to be useful. And it might not be either. So doubt can be a really good thing. So I prefer the language of a lack of confidence in oneself as the hindrance. A lack of confidence in oneself. That's the problem. Yeah, not backing myself in this situation, that I can do something about this situation. Also, too much certainty that this is true. Or this is not true. Yeah, too much certainty in that way. Instead, of course, what happens when I hold this view? What does it do to my sense of me? What does it do to my sense of what I'm meeting? What does it do to the sense of dukkha in this moment? Those of you who know this path well will know that there's a principle on the Eightfold Path called right view. Yeah, right view. It's not called right truth. It's called right view. It's an encouragement to take a view, take a lens, take a perspective, see things this way. Yeah? It's quite an important distinction. And as I said, I think the Buddha was clever, wise, and poetic. He chose their words well. See things this way. This relates to the principle of appropriate attention. Pay attention in this way. And you'll find freedom. So coming back to the Buddha's discipline, yeah? Discipline with these teachings, keeping it on track, keeping it on track. Right? We're just opening things out a little bit there and keeping it back on track again. Right? So why? Why are we talking about all of this? And we know why. The vending machine only has one button. Freedom from dukkha. Yeah. And there are no other vending machines. So this is what we get, yeah. The discipline was amazing. So the people would come to the Buddha with all these kind of fantastical questions about the universe, you know, where did it come from, where's it going, are there other ones, what came before, you know, what was it like, what will happen to us after this, will there be another world, do we really exist or not exist? And then the Buddha would just say, it's not a valid question. You know, even if you had an answer to these questions, or you just kept on questing, you're not going to get to a place of a resolved ease with these questions, yeah? And would bring them back to this sense of the dependent origination of stress. How does stress come about? What's it depending on? And how can we get out of this? So the Four Noble Truths, a very famous teaching of the Buddha, which I will, in a moment, butcher in front of you, which means, you know, make a mess of, is dependent origination in a nutshell, encapsulated. It's dependent origination, it's the Dharma, in a simple little phrase. The most precise and also probably the most pertinent, which means relevant to our lives, means meaningful to us, is do you experience dukkha, stress, ill-being, agitation, lack of peace, non-freedom? Do you understand how this happens? Do you realize it can end? And will you walk the path to its end? Do you experience dukkha? Do you understand how this happens? Do you realize it can end? And will you walk the path? That's what it said on the back of the vending machine anyway, as I recall. Yeah, we bring this righted view. Yeah, bring our view to a place where we can align it correctly. And then we bring these skillful intentions that arise from this view. Yeah, the intentions arise from the view, from the value, from what we hold as meaningful. That's where they come from. Yeah. So right view brings skillful intentions, which brings wise effort, which brings acts of caring response, and encourages our creative hearts, and our transcendent minds into an engagement with reality, which radically changes reality. Yeah. Radically changes reality. I want to speak a bit about reality, actually. I've had enough of reality, haven't we? Yeah. But maybe first of all, just a little bit more about, do you know how this dukkha happens? It's basically what we continuously talk about. Is like, well, how does dukkha happen? So the first thing to know about dukkha is it's conditioned. It's not unconditioned. There are conditions contributing to dukkha to be this way. Yeah, it can't survive without these conditions. That's what the Third Noble Truth is saying. Okay, now you play a part in the conditions. You play a part in these conditions. A few people have asked me recently, do we have to accept dukkha? Which I think is a lovely, lovely question. And I think, you know, there is a place for wise acceptance. We accept it happens. We accept that right now it is happening to some degree. Maybe it's subtle, maybe it's obvious, maybe it's large, maybe it's quite small. There is a hindrance, even subtly, that we could be resolving, bringing to the still point within the matrix of hindrances, yeah. So we accept that it happens, and we also accept it can't last, and we also accept that it's conditioned. It's not unconditioned. So dukkha's conditioned, not unconditioned. So the second question really is asking, and what are the conditions? Right, what are the conditions? The fourth question is asking us, will we decommission those conditions? Which means, will we cease to keep building those conditions? So the Buddha spoke about one in particular, which has the translation of tanha. Many times we use this word craving. I think that's a little bit unfair. We don't really use the word craving a lot in everyday language in England at this time. But it's kind of existing in Dharma teachings. You know, you've got to end your craving. And we all kind of agree, yes, we've got to end that craving. But no one really thinks that they do a lot of craving. Like basically, the only people who crave are pregnant women who ask you to buy ice cream in the, you know, from the garage at midnight, which isn't what we mean by craving. What we mean is making unreasonable demands on existence. Asking for ice cream at midnight when you're pregnant is not unreasonable, right? Of course it's not. A perfectly sensible thing to ask for. But instead, we actually make unreasonable demands on existence all of the time. We ask for pleasures to stick around, unpleasant things to leave just when we want them to, you know, selves to be perfect. All kinds of unreasonable demands. And when there are unreasonable demands, there is stress. Yeah, if you make an impossible demand and you don't feel stress, you know, your nervous system isn't wired up correctly. Right? That's the experience of an unreasonable demand. Incredibly stressful. So the Buddha was right, I think, to pick on that one. But I think there's also a possibility of taking this second noble truth and just treating it as an open question, as if the Buddha hasn't already answered it for us. When there's dukkha, what else is there? When there's dukkha, what else is there? Now, I'm happy for you to take that away as a skillful question. That's a question that will lead you to freedom. When there's dukkha, what else is there? But we can also take some pointers from these teachings. So what else is there? Okay, so we've got this obsessive demand, this unreasonable, impossible demand on life. Am I making one of those right now? Yes. Okay, shall I stop? I think I probably should. Okay, let's stop doing that. Oh, that's not so easy. Is there something more easy? Well, what else is there? Well, there's this tightness in my belly. There's this furrow in my brow. You know, there's this contraction in the being. That's always there when there's dukkha. And we've talked about this already. It's like, actually, let's soften the contraction. Let's get into some space. You don't need this tension. Don't need to fight. Oh, yeah, that is a bit better. And we'll notice what we then notice. Ah, there's kind of an uncaring or an unkind attitude to something, somewhere, when there's dukkha. Some unkindness, uncaring attitude. Well, I could change that. Okay, this is working. What else is there? Time pressure. Huh, there's a real sense of urgency. Gotta deal with this now. All right, there's dukkha. I'll put it off for later. Like, no, it's dukkha. You know, my knee hurts. And it's dukkha. Gotta do it now. Self-centered. It's very self-centered, isn't it, dukkha, as well? I want this. I don't want this. I'm in the center of this story, and I'm in charge, and I am making the dukkha. And another one is that the sense of the thing, the sense of the thing is very solid. It's become really real, amplified. Yeah, quite fixed. So it's interesting, all of these things build up, and you could think at this point, shit, there's really quite a lot there. This is worse than it first sounded. You know, in the beginning, we just had obsessive demands, you know, before that we had craving, and I don't crave, I'm not craving. The dukkha's going to go soon. You know, but now I realize if I keep myself in the center and I allow things to have solidity and a sense of time that has pressure, there's almost no way out. Oh my God, it's so complex. There's so much to understand. There's so much to do. How am I going to unpick this, like, it's like, you know, a sewing kit that's gotten all jumbled together and all the threads are tangled there. It's like, oh, it's going to take forever to undo all these threads of dukkha. And that can be how it seems in that situation. But the interesting thing is this story of how many conditions come together to make dukkha actually doesn't make the problem worse. It doesn't actually make the problem deeper. And it doesn't actually make it more complicated or longer to resolve. Instead, it actually invites us for more ways in. There's more ways to dissolve your dukkha. Just remember a few years ago, I think 50 ways to leave your dukkha. Just remember that one. You pull on any one of these threads and all the others collapse. All the others collapse. Yeah. Even if they don't seem connected in this moment, you pull on any of them, the edifice crumbles like a house of cards. Yeah. Pull any one of these cards and the whole thing is going to start going. Yeah. The more important question is, why does dukkha care about the angle of your shoulders? Yeah, I'm going to bring those down. And dukkha's like, no, keep them up. No, I'm going to bring them down. No, okay. I'm going to go now, somewhat, yeah? Why does it care about the softness of your belly, the length of your breathing, the amount of kindness in your heart? Why does it care about that? Because it's conditioned, it's not unconditioned. It needs conditions, yeah? So I said I was going to pick on reality a little bit before we close, and now that my band's back, I thought they had gone there. They're so much better than me. So we tend to think that we experience reality, and we believe it. We believe this reality. We invest in it. One example I've had in my life, I've heard others speak about it in this week, is you get that inner voice defining, narrating your experience. You get that sometimes, telling you what's happening, and you believe it. Yeah. And then sometimes it says things about us. You've had enough. You can't go any longer. You're done. Stop. Yeah. Sometimes get that voice. It's a weird one, isn't it? But you may notice it's actually one of the levers. I didn't really explain this. It's one of the conditions, yeah, in dukkha. Any of those conditions actually becomes a lever or something that we can move, we can play with. I often think about a sound mixing desk, which I have no experience using. But it feels to me that, like, when you pull down on contraction, somehow it's linked up to the sense of self, and you can pull down on contraction, sense of self goes down, you can push up on the sense of self, contraction goes up, and you can kind of like, is this how these work? I don't know. Probably not. They're probably not really linked, but somehow for me they're linked together. There's probably some special program you do that makes them link, but anyway. So it's like you can amplify dukkha and you can bring it down with any of these levers. So we've noticed one here, yeah, which is I'm believing the narration that I tell myself, that fixed idea, that limited, fixed, narrow sense of self view that I can have. And with it comes this time pressure. With it comes this obsessive demand. With it comes this contraction. And interestingly, we can disbelieve this story. Yeah, you've got to stop now. You can't meditate any longer. But you've actually now got all of these possible things to do. Oh, I don't know, maybe should we just soften the contraction a little bit? See if that does it. It's actually one of my favorite times to practice nowadays. When the mind turns up and says, that's it, you're done, you're cooked, stop, you can't do any more. I think, oh, great. There's a freedom about to arrive. What should we do? Soften. Let's bring kindness. Let's practice kindness. And in fact, already the moment of feeling grateful that dukkha has arrived makes a difference. Yeah. And we keep working into this, work into the cracks in experience, and it opens out into doorways, avenues of freedom. Brings us to that still point, yeah, and the matrix of the hindrances. Dissolving the restlessness in a skillful response. So we tend to think we experience reality and we believe it. But what we experience is a perception of reality, and that's not the same thing. We tend to think we experience reality, but we experience a perception of reality. And what the practice of meditation reveals is that perceptions can be changed. Perceptions can be changed. And how much it can change. And this is one of the most skillful ways of bringing dukkha to an end. Changing our perception of our experience of reality. One of the most inspiring teachers of our modern times, Rob Babea, called this practice the poetry of perception. And I think it's no accident that the Buddha was a poet, a real poet. Check out their works in that way. It's also one of the reasons why we ask you not to read and write on retreats, so that your poetic gifts come into your perception, your ways of attending. Yeah. You need your creativity for this practice to reshape your perception of reality. So reality, whatever that is only revealed through a glimmer of how your sense of things are at this time. Yeah, how you sense things to be. And in every moment, that sense of things is sensed as being reality from its own side. But it can't be, because it changes. All the practices of meditation change the perception of reality. And each time they change, we feel like, oh yeah, now I'm seeing reality, which is how it's meant to be. That's not a mistake, yeah. The goal is not, how do I stop thinking that reality is reality? It's like, no, that's just what you think. But the idea is to generate the kind of reality that brings the maximum amount of freedom. So a little bit of doubt is really helpful there. There's a teacher called Chandrakirti. He's an ancient teacher, he's not around anymore. And he would say, one who sees dependent arising correctly does not perceive a substance, even in subtle things. Things appear to have their own reality from their own side. But the more and more we explore the dependent arising, dependent origination, which is there as the seed of that question, what is the conditions for dukkha? Is a question of the dependent arising of dukkha. What does dukkha depend on? Yeah. The more that you explore that, you do not find a substance, substantiality, independent reality, even to the subtlest of things. And this is not being clever, it's being useful. All the greed and aversion in the world depends on a grand mistake. All the greed and aversion in the world depends on a grand mistake. It depends on the fundamental delusion that satisfaction and dissatisfaction exist in things. That happiness comes from arranging the world a certain way. And this is both stressful and misleading. Happiness and dissatisfaction do not exist in things. They exist and they occur in our way of relating to things. Our way of relating to things that conditions things to become dukkha. For as long as we believe in the substantiality of things, yeah, we turn away from happiness. There is a peace possible. There is a freedom possible for us. But it's quite a different way of going about things than we might be used to. All the practices that we do reveal that there is no way anything is really. There is no way anything is really. Because we change the conditions and we change how things are for us. We see that time and time again, and then we go back to a view is like, now I see how they really are. Do you recognize when you experience dukkha that you're experiencing dukkha? Do you recognize that it's conditioned and not unconditioned? And do you recognize that you could change one of those conditions and that changes everything? I'll say some more about this tomorrow, but maybe that's enough for tonight. Over to the band to play us out with a silent minute together. Softening the body. Releasing demands for things to be otherwise. Allowing the self to leave the center of this story.